from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up this hour, a look at the Trump administration's latest attempt to push back against a court-ordered limit on the detention of migrant children, and what his move could mean for the 500 migrant kids still separated from their parents and the future of family detention. And then at 10:30, the Asian American vote has been largely ignored by both major political parties. But as the fastest growing racial group in the country, the Asian American electorate is a political force to be reckoned with. We'll take a look at that emerging voting bloc. We'll get started with Forum right after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim. Well, on Thursday, the Trump administration took steps toward backing out of the 1997 court agreement known as the Flores Settlement. That's the one that stipulates the conditions under which immigrant children can be detained and limits holding them to 20 days. Immigration rights and child advocates say the changes proposed by the Trump administration could lead to the indefinite detention of children and would remove critical court oversight. So today, for this first half hour, we're discussing what overturning the Flores settlement could mean for the nearly 500 immigrant kids who are still separated from their parents and for the future of U.S. immigration policy more generally. Joining us, Nick Miroff. He's national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Nick, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be with you guys.
And with me here in the studio, Tyke Hendricks, immigration and criminal justice editor here at KQED and author of The Wind Doesn't Need a Passport, Stories from the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. Welcome, Tyke.
Hi, Scott.
Let me begin with you, Tyke. Just give us some background on this Flores settlement going back to 1997, Clinton administration. Right. What was it?
So came out of a lawsuit that was filed in the 80s on behalf of some migrant kids. And in 1997, as you say, there was a stipulated settlement agreement. One thing, I mean, basically the premise, I think, is to say that it's harmful for children to be held in jail-like conditions, even if it's an immigration kind of a jail. So the settlement agreement says that kids should be held in the least restrictive setting possible. They should be released as soon as possible to a parent or another relative or an approved sponsor. And that the facilities, the shelters, and other places where children are held need to be licensed for child care. So if they're going to be held in, for example, family detention that's run by ICE rather than the Human Services Agency that's overseeing the kids, they shouldn't be kept there for very long. And the judge recently said 20 days is the limit for that.
And was that settlement aimed? It seems like it may not have anticipated the current situation where kids are coming with their families. Is that true, or was it? What I don't know what the case stemmed
right,
from.
Right, and there were a lot fewer kids coming generally unaccompanied in those days. But the judge ruled a couple years ago that it does. The judge who's overseeing the suit, Judge Dolly G, who's down in federal court in Los Angeles, that the settlement covers kids who are unaccompanied, but also kids who are with their parents. And in the last several years, we've had a big influx of both unaccompanied children and children with parents coming specifically from Central America seeking refuge here.
And is it true that this is the Trump administration is not the first to try to, you know, get around this settlement?
Well, in the 2014, 2015, when the numbers of families was increasing, the Obama administration began expanding family detention under, as I said, under Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And these are jail-like facilities and wanted to put the kids and parents in those places and did. And the lawyers for the plaintiffs in the Flores agreement went to the judge and said, wait, this isn't right. And the judge said, correct, you can't hold them for indefinite periods in these family jails. And so at that point, the Obama administration started releasing more families on bond with electronic ankle monitors and so forth. So I think, you know, it's interesting to note that detention isn't the only option. There are other approaches.
And Nick Muroff, if you want to add anything to that, go ahead. But also, what changes is the Trump administration trying to get now in this case?
Well, the scenario we've been talking about is really what the administration sees and calls a loophole, and believes that the inability to keep children in detention has created an incentive for more families to try to come, and for parents to bring children, almost as a kind of like get out of detention free card. So the whole family separation controversy that we witnessed this spring and that really blew up in the administration's face was an attempt to kind of get around this, right, by rather than, you know, releasing from custody parents who arrive with children, keeping the parents in detention and sending their children to shelters run by HHS. Now, the administration has backed off of that. And what we're seeing now with this proposal yesterday is another prong, really, of the administration's strategy to try to be able to detain families and to keep parents who bring children in custody in order, they say, to ensure they will comply with their court calendars and not disappear underground. So what the change would do is it would really lift the restrictions on the government's ability to detain children at length. And a series of other things, you know, that address, you know, what until now have been the guidance to keep kids in the least restrictive setting possible.
Taiki?
Yeah. So what the government's proposing is regulations that would supersede this legal settlement agreement. And in fact, the agreement itself says, you know, this is only in place until the government comes up with some regulations. Up until now, that hasn't happened over the last, you know, 20, 30 years. 20 years, I guess.
20, 21.
Yes, 20. So the rules, I think, as Nick was saying, the regulation basically would say we don't need state licensing of childcare facilities in order to put kids in a place. And so we can use these family detention centers. And if states won't license them, we're coming up with a new scheme that would allow for some kind of federal licensing, and that would enable it would enable the government to keep kids indefinitely in these settings with their parents.
And Nick, is there any pushback from children's advocates and others that this settlement can be replaced by simple regulations that the Trump administration could issue?
Yeah, there's a lot of pushback, and this is going to go straight back to court, and we'll. I spoke yesterday with one of the lead attorneys who represents migrant children, and they're planning to seek an injunction from Judge G. I should also point out, you know, that part of what is prompting this is that the administration and Homeland Security officials in particular feel that, you know, that they can't really accomplish what they want with Judge G. Having this much say and really kind of acting as a referee over, you know, what the standards of immigration detention are. In July, they went to Judge G filed a motion really seeking to be able to do this, to extend the amount of time that children can be held in ICE custody with their parents. And the judge, you know, really kind of slapped it down. And so I think there's a broader frustration with the way that this process has gone and the way that, you know, they're not able to really to tighten enforcement standards and carry out some of their enforcement objectives with a federal judge, really kind of siding with the plaintiffs and blocking what they're attempting to do.
All right. You're listening to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today. And for this half hour, we're talking about the Trump administration's efforts to change rules on detention of child immigrants. Our guests are Nick Muroff, national security reporter with The Washington Post, and Taiki Hendricks, immigration and criminal justice editor. It is a half hour segment. So if you'd like to weigh in, give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. To both of you, Nick, you first, a judge several weeks ago ordered that these kids be reunited with their families. What's the status of that?
Well, the status is the reunification process is moving along at a snail's pace. There are, I believe, more than 400 mm-hmm. Families that remain separated out of the original 2,600 or so. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of these represent, or a lot of these are families who, parents who were deported back to Central America in the earlier stages of the family separation system that the administration implemented this spring. And so
why didn't they reunite the kids with the families before they sent them back?
Because, well, according to DHS, the parents consented to be deported without their kids. Now, it's important to point out that
what they were doing.
If they understood, right, and that is really at the heart of this. And what the judge has said is that it's the government's fault that these families are separated, and it's the government's responsibility to put them back together. But the administration insists that these parents consented to be sent back without their kids. And it's true that some of the parents have opted to have their children remain here, possibly with another relative, or because they, you know, they've already kind of invested in this long journey, and their kids can have a separate court case and as well as kind of a better shot at being allowed to stay.
And so, Taiki, this effort mm-hmm. to get around the Flores Agreement or to yeah. replace it with regulations, what impact, if any, would it have on these, you know, nearly 500 kids who are still in detention?
Well, one thing that the proposed regulations talks about is disallowing releasing children to anyone but a parent or a legal guardian. So currently, a child in federal custody in the Department of Health and Human Services in a shelter could be released to another relative if a parent wasn't available or some vetted sponsor. The new regulations would say only to a parent. And now in the case of these families that Nick's talking about, you know, most of those parents have been deported. So if the kid is going to be released from custody, if these regulations were implemented, you know, that it would complicate that.
Why would the Trump administration, why do you imagine they would want to issue regulations that would make it harder to get these children out of detention?
Well, I think that these are sort of on parallel tracks, and the reunifying of those separated families is going slowly, and that's partly because there's been a painstaking effort by the ACLU and advocates they're working with to track down the parents, because the government, once someone's deported, they don't necessarily keep track of where they are. So it's been challenging to find the parents who've been deported and then check with them and make sure that, you know, do they want their child sent back to their home country? Do they want their child to stay here? But that, I think, will be playing out, one imagines, over the next couple of months. And meanwhile, there's a 60-day public comment period for these regulations. So these may not go into effect for some time. And as I think Nick mentioned, there's likely to be, you know, legal challenges both under Judge Gee's authority and then potentially other kinds of lawsuits filed over the regulations.
And Nick, what is your sense of the extent to which, you know, all of this is really about sending a message to people who haven't yet crossed the border to mm-hmm. like, don't even bother, don't try?
Well, Homeland Security officials are always very careful to avoid saying that they're taking measures to deter future behavior. But
why? Got in trouble.
That
with
is
that.
Really at the core of this.
Why? Well, they got in trouble because in federal court over that, right?
That's right. That's right. They've gotten in trouble over federal court, and they're not. There are basically legal reasons why they're not supposed to implement measures with that goal. But I can tell you that, you know, based on years of reporting and speaking to Border Patrol officials and, you know, ICE agents and everyone really that is part of the immigration enforcement apparatus, that this is always viewed through a prism of deterrence and strength and weakness, and the vision and the view that if we're too friendly, too generous, too accommodating to people who are coming illegally, then that will incentivize future law breaking and the problem will get worse. And so toughness, and you see that in the president's kind of the way he talks about these issues and his approach to it, that's very much reflected in his speaking.
And is there evidence that that's having an impact on border crossings?
I mean, they would say it is, but I think the numbers really, you know, they do not support that conclusion. In fact, what we saw during the whole spring episode of the family separation policy was that the border apprehension numbers, which are the commonly kind of accepted way of measuring, you know, illegal migration flows, that they, you know, really didn't change significantly. And in fact, you know, family units continue to be an even greater share of those who are coming illegally.
Taking anything to add to that?
Well, just that there are so many factors. You know, there's
the economy,
U.S. enforcement. There's the economy in this country. There, what are people leaving in their home countries? Both economic and political and social instability.
We've got a comment from Joseph who asks, are most of the detentions a result of illegal crossing? Why are the detainees not immediately returned to the border? Nick?
Sure, I can take that. You know, in many cases, these people are coming and stating a fear of being sent back to their home countries, citing, you know, the threats from gangs or from you know, other kind of generalized lawlessness in what is one of the most violent and dangerous regions in the world. And so when they arrive and they say that they have a fear of being, you know, returned to their home countries, they're administered a what's called a credible fear interview. And if a U.S. asylum officer finds that they have, you know, a credible fear of being persecuted or harmed when they return home, then they enter into, you know, a legal process, and they have due process rights under our immigration system that allows them, you know, to remain and try to make their case for asylum.
And have the criteria for that changed under this president?
They have. The Attorney General has taken major steps to tighten up that process and issued a ruling in July, I believe, that essentially said that the United States cannot protect or grant asylum to people who are fleeing what he called private forms of violence, citing things like gang violence or domestic violence. And he, you know, he's really attempting to put the asylum, to narrow the asylum process to people who are fleeing things like political and religious persecution.
And one of the reasons, my understanding, is that one of the reasons that people are being detained for longer periods of time and that these asylum cases are all backed up is that there aren't enough judges, immigration judges. And the Trump administration, I think Attorney General Sessions, has asked for more judges to be added. What's the status of that?
There were a few more judges added. There's a historic backlog. I think it's over 700,000 cases, you know, in the immigration court system. And it does lead to very long proceedings that can go on for months and sometimes years. And this administration has said from the outset that our presumption is to detain people while they're in immigration proceedings, not to let them live in the community.
Is that happening?
And that is happening.
Because it's not an illegal border crossing, is it, if you come over seeking asylum?
No, I mean
it's still an illegal. I mean, well, yes and no. I mean, it is an illegal. You've made an illegal entry,
depending on how you present yourself, whether you're coming to a port of entry or in between, right? But you still have a right to pursue asylum, even if you cross the border unlawfully.
Nick, did you want to add something?
That's right. So, for example, during when the family separation system was in place. parents who were coming seeking asylum were being charged. And if they presented themselves at ports of entry, they didn't face criminal charges. But if they came between the ports of entry, such as like crossing the Rio Grande, they would be prosecuted typically with a misdemeanor charge. And that prosecution is what the government used to separate the parents and children, even though those parents were typically sentenced just to time served. Now, they have the legal right to pursue the asylum claim, but if you enter the country between a port of entry, that's an illegal act.
Here's a comment from Rick, who writes, "Guess what, Blue America? Trump is what you get when you advocate for open borders. The majority of Americans reject this mess that dates from 1986. That would be immigration reform, I assume, under Ronald Reagan. Trump is just the beginning if you, we cannot find a mutually agreed way to stem this flow." Kind of a political question here. You know, this has been a crazy week in Washington. And anonymous op-eds complaining about all kinds of things, the Woodward book. Now, I haven't read it, but, you know, in all of this, there has been, I haven't heard anybody being upset about immigration policy. Is it your sense, Taiki, that, you know, maybe the folks who are on the inside of the White House, the so-called inside resistance, are just fine with this?
Well, to a slightly different point, and really to what the commenter's point is, I mean, illegal immigration is actually way down, and relative to the last, I would say, 20 years. So there's a lot of focus right now on the migration of families and children, and you know, illegal immigration and entries by those folks. But overall, there's a lot less illegal immigration. So there's a lot of, and certainly President Trump himself has spent a lot of energy talking about it, and. So that sort of makes it loom large, I think, in the public consciousness.
But. And Nick, in your reporting as national security correspondent, I mean, are you hearing, I mean, John Kelly, for example, the president's chief of staff, military guy, has been fairly supportive and pretty vocal, at least at the beginning, about toughening up the borders. I mean, is it your sense that there is consensus within the National Security Intelligence Committee community about this?
I think there is. I mean, in you know, broadly within the kind of Homeland Security establishment and within the national security, you know, folks inside the White House, I don't think there's a ton of disagreement. And there's a sense that you know, the president is kind of on the side of law enforcement and that tougher measures are warranted, even if, you know, even if there has been disagreement over things like the, you know, family separation.
Taiki, just a few seconds left, but what should we be looking for? What are the next steps as this apparent issuing of new regulations proceeds?
Right. Well, there's 60 days for public comment. And then if the regulations are finalized, then 45 days after, the Flores settlement agreement, it says it should go away. But there will be challenges, and the lawyers, the plaintiff's lawyers in the Flores case, are already asking Judge G to, you know, to consider an injunction if these regulations don't meet the standards that Flores set out.
So yet another issue we may see play out in the courts at different levels in the coming weeks and months ahead. All right. Thank you so much, Taiki Hendricks, immigration and criminal justice editor here at KQED, and Nick Miroff, national security reporter from The Washington Post. Thank you both very much. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk about Asian-American voters, an important voting bloc that often doesn't get much attention from the political parties and from campaigns. We'll talk about why that might be so and what impact that electorate could have on the midterm elections. I'm Scott Schaefer, here for Mina Kim. Stay with us.